I'd like to call the meeting to order. The Housing Finance and Policy Committee. Welcome, everybody. I haven't seen some of you for a while. I'm glad we're all here and made it through the snow drifts and everything, right, Representative Anderson? That's a good story there. Thank you, everybody, for coming. And I want to thank the audience for coming. This is an informational hearing today. We're not officially in session, so we won't be able to take any action, but we thought we'd get a jump start on a bill that seems pretty important to the community, and so we're going to go ahead and hear House File 1941, Representative Dean's bill on mortgage foreclosure mediation established. So we're going to ask him to come to the desk here, and we have a list of testifiers, both supporters and opponents, and we're going to go through those lists. You all should have that on your agenda. And then we'll have a chance for others who may not have had a chance to sign up ahead of time. I've got one person who's done that. If you want to testify and you haven't signed up, would you send up a note here so that Martha can put you on the list, and we'll have a few minutes, hopefully, to do that. Just want to ask everyone, because we have a lot of interest in this bill, testifiers, to please try to stick to a 2-3 minute testifying list, if you can do that. It gives you a chance to hopefully make your point, but also for legislators to ask questions. And we want to have a good dialogue today and respectful dialogue. This is one of those issues that has a lot of feelings around it. We know that people are deeply affected by the issues of foreclosure. So please, let's all be respectful of each other and hear all the points pro and con. And we're going to go ahead and start now, and I'd like to welcome Representative Dean to the committee, and go ahead and you can go ahead and present your bill.
Great, thank you, Madam Chair and members. Thank you for the opportunity to bring this bill before you today, prior to actual start of session. I want to start by sort of congratulating all of us for the work that was done last session on some of the issues around mortgage foreclosure. It was kindly known as the Homeowner Bill of Rights that was passed, and it did some things that were alleviating some, you know, some practices out there that were catching a lot of homeowners in tough situations, and ultimately they were losing their homes. As part of that process, one of the pieces that were dropped off on the bill we were working on last year was mediation. And so we've come back this year and have been working on a bill that will address the issue of mediation as part of the process prior to foreclosure. The bill that I have before you today isn't the perfect bill. We know that. It still has some work to be done. We're going to continue to work on it over the next few weeks. I have had the chance to meet with advocates on both sides of the issue and have heard their concerns, and I think some of them are valid and reasonable concerns that will need to get addressed as we move forward. But we did want to bring this forward. We did want to talk about it. And we did want to get, you know, comments and input from folks as well. For those of you who don't know and haven't had a chance, I'm going to briefly go through the bill. What it does is, within the process of foreclosure, it adds another step within that process. It's not another step that's added after the process goes through. And what it does is it allows automatic mediation to become part of the process. So at the time when a foreclosing entity makes the decision to begin the process of foreclosing, although not actually filing for foreclosing, foreclosing on a property, they then have to notify the homeowner that they have the ability to go through mediation. And we've created a program that actually has an opt-out for the homeowner. So, for instance, if the homeowner knows that they're in a very, very difficult financial situation, and they know that chances are they're not going to be able to get to a point where they might be able to hang on to their home, they have the option of opting out. Now, another option is, you know, this thing does not need to proceed as long as the bank continues to try to work on some type of modification or some type of workout with the homeowner. So whereas, although this process would start after about 90 days, the bank can continue to work with the homeowner to work on a modification, and if that's an extra 30 days or an extra 60 days to try to figure something out, they're certainly able to do that prior to going through this process. Once this process starts, the Office of Administration, of OAH, they will send out a notice to both parties around the issues of setting up a mediation date. A mediator will be assigned to the process, and then the homeowner and the bank will come to that mediation process and talk about a situation where there might be the ability for working out a particular modification or some other type of workout that the homeowner and the bank can agree upon. The mediator will play a role and will make their recommendation. And the key component of the mediation is from that the bank will need to receive an affidavit of good faith. So in other words, the bank has come and has tried good faith to say that we have tried to keep this homeowner in their homes through a process that we believe is valid. And if the mediator then gives the foreclosing entity that affidavit, at that point, they can then proceed with the process of foreclosure. And with the changes we've made in law last year, everything will proceed along the same way. If the mediator determines that the bank has not acted in good faith in this process, then they have to wait a period of 1 year before they can actually foreclose on the house. Another thing that this bill does, which I think is critical to consider, it also requires subsequent lien holders to also participate in the mediation process. So we won't have a situation where the primary lien holder will be in the mediation process, come to an agreement, and then have a secondary lien holder say, well, we didn't agree to this, so we're going to sue you for the full value of that. So we want them to be involved in the process as well, and that's all secondary lien holders. And if they do not participate in the mediation process, ultimately they would give up their right to that lien as well. So that in a nutshell is what the bill is, and I know we have a few testimonies, but prior to that, I'd be willing to take one or two questions maybe from members.
Any questions? Sounds like maybe we should go ahead with your witnesses.
Okay. So Ann Haynes is going to come forward. She's a St. Paul homeowner, and she's going to tell her story about what she's been going through in the past several months.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Haynes.
Hello, my name is Ann Haynes, and I live at 1311 Seminary Avenue in St. Paul, Minnesota. In the summer of 2011, I was having a hard time making my monthly mortgage payments and reached out to the bank to see what my options were. I was told because I was making the payments, they couldn't offer any modification. I explained to them that I was able to make the payments, but one whole paycheck would go to my housing and it caused difficulty for me to pay other bills and support my children. They said the only way they could help is if I stopped making the payments. With great reservation, I stopped. In the fall, I received notification that my house was in pre-foreclosure and to contact Ramsey County Housing Counseling Services. I met with the counselor and we filled out the first loan modification application. It was sent in and I didn't hear back from neither the bank nor the counselor. In December, I received another modification application and was asked to fill it out and send it back in. The communication between the bank and myself was very, very poor, and I wasn't sure where I was in the process of the modification. I was ashamed, afraid, embarrassed that this was happening, but I was hopeful and had faith that the modification request would go through. It did not. After asking for help from different people and organizations, I was encouraged to contact Southern Metro Regional Legal Services for help. Larry Maloney was assigned to my case, and we met and made our first call to the bank, where we both were informed that the application was denied. Further into the conversation, it was discovered that the bank sent the wrong application to me. I was here last year testifying my story in the hopes that this bill would pass. On April 16, 2013, I traveled to Boise, Idaho to attend and speak at the U.S. Bank shareholders meeting to share my story with the CEO himself. We did come to an agreement, and I am still living in my home, but we're still disputing some of the details of that agreement. It is my belief that if there were a third party to help mediate in my case, many of the things that happened would have been avoided. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Haynes. Any questions, committee members, comments? Thank you very much.
Okay, Madam Chair and members, the next speaker is Howard Crutcher. North Minneapolis homeowner.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Community. My name is Howard Frutcher. To start out right now, I've been a resident of Minneapolis since the early 70s. So my home is actually back where I started from anyway. A little bit about myself. My education actually brought me to work with my community. Behavior specialist in the school district. I've done correctional service, coaching, mental illness, a bunch of things like that. So I'm a single father of two kids. When I finally got the opportunity to build my home, I designed it and done it myself. I've actually had my kids in there to learn some of that stuff too. Getting off of work and going there till 2 a.m. every day for a year and a half to be able to live in my home with my kids. So you can see the importance of me fighting to try to keep my home. A little over 2.5 years ago, my foreclosure process had started. Being laid off, there's no school, summer school, being laid off, that's how I fell behind. Once I finally caught up with that to bring my mortgage current, City Mortgage finally told me, because that current payment that was a little over 15 days late, they would no longer take my payments. That's when my foreclosure process started. Knowing a little bit about the system and everything else, I wound up contacting Habitat for Humanities. I was smart enough to also contact the FHA Servicing Center, where the FHA loan probably originated from. I had a counselor there that was working with me. I had a counselor with Habitat for Humanities working with me. And through the grace of God, meeting NCRC, one of the greatest groups in the community that followed them, they helped me push through a lot of different things. You know, one of my issues that I went through with City is the fact that they constantly kept telling me that they were losing my documents and my paperwork. You know, and my thing is, I'm on top of all of my business. I made sure that I sent this documentation to them. Not only that, I've had the FHA Servicing Center sending these documents to them. NCRC, which I did conference calls with them and fax information with them. And they constantly told me that they didn't have the documents, and they pushed my issue out for over a year. And didn't tell me that in this 12 months, this is what I learned, that after 12 months, I no longer qualify for any government programs, anything, that I got pushed into a modification that they wanted to give me in order to keep my house. I was forced to take that, which kept my mortgage payment totally high. I'm a little emotional about my house and everything else and the situation that I went through for them to push this out for 12 months. And I really think NCRC, with the help that they had, you know, keeping my head up and everything else. And also, I'm a behavior specialist in the school district. I've done mediations with my students. That helped out a lot. I've been in an accident before, and I pray to God I never get into another one again. And I understand that with the insurance company, that they do, you know, things with a mediator to get that stuff across. And I definitely think that the banks and the community and everything else, if they had a mediator, my situation wouldn't have went a year. And right now I'm in that same situation. You know, my house, if they check the value of my house right now, the market value, and they look at it and say, oh, your house is probably worth $116,000, but your mortgage payment or your mortgage is $250,000, for them to send me through this right now. And I definitely think passing this bill with this mediation thing would be a great thing for the community. I think right now, if I had it right now, it would help with my situation. So, I mean, you guys have any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Any questions from committee members? Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And thanks for testifying, Mr. Crutcher. Just a question. You mentioned your modification payment was high. Was it as high as your original mortgage payment?
Yes, it was.
Mr. Crutcher.
Yep.
I have a question, Mr. Crutcher. Has there been any, have you tried to, we don't have the law in place yet that we're talking about here, but has there been any effort to actually get them to the table to do any mediation that this would allow us to, would allow to happen? Has that happened lately, or is it, how long is it since you've had that kind of,
you know what,
suggestion
this
on the table?
This is the situation with me. I was forced into taking a modification that kept my mortgage payment high. And they said I would have to deal with that payment for a year. Strong enough, I did that. I made every last one of them payments for a full year. Once again, summertime, I'm out of work, I fell behind. I called city probably 3 to 4 days out of every week for a year to let them know what was going on, to make sure they had every documentation they needed. I did conference calls. I worked with them, strongly worked with them to keep in contact and letting them know what's going on. Every single time I called them, either the rep that they signed was no longer there, or once again, my documentation is not there. I think with a mediator, if he had the same documentation, he would be able to say, you know what, this young man sent the documentation to you, I sent the documentation to you, and matter of fact, to have them tell me when I call that this is being recorded for legal purposes. If it's recorded and I stated in this thing saying that are all of my documentation is there, and they say yes, and they sent it to their people to have it done, I don't think that should be something that we should be hearing all the time. You know, these are the tricks and trades that they sent me through for over a year. And I think with a mediator, they would no longer be able to say, we lost your documentation. I think that a mediator would be able to handle a situation and have it done within probably 3 months versus a year. So I strongly agree that a mediator would work in a situation like this. You know.
Thank you.
I mentioned to city, you know, when they told me that this is being recorded for legal purposes. So I said, okay, ma'am, are you able to speak with me if this is being recorded on my end for legal purposes? They said, no, we can no longer speak with you.
Interesting. Well, I'm just checking here with my staff because I know that the difficulty of having different people every time you call back has been an issue, and I know that I think we conformed with the federal law, single point of contact. Mm-hmm. It doesn't sound like it was effective, or I'm not quite sure why not. Maybe I went in back in January. Oh, okay. Well, that should be something that hopefully we can check into as in terms of enforcement. I mean, that sounds like an issue that needs to be. I just thank you for your testimony. You provide a lot of very helpful information.
Thank you.
And if I could just add, Madam Chair, we also have language here calling out the single point of contact as well.
Say that?
We also have in the bill, and there will be in the bill, in the a single point of contact.
Okay, thank you so much. Appreciate that. Okay. Thank you for your testimony.
Oh, Madam Chair.
I'm sorry. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I think, was that for that witness?
Did you want?
I have their
witness.
I'm sorry, Mr. Crutcher, I didn't catch that. There's another question for you.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's okay.
Thank you so much for coming and testifying today. And I really applaud you for all the work that you put into your home and, you know, the blood, sweat, and tears that went into that. And I really want to applaud you. I just have a really small clarification question just so I can get my mind around your story and really understand your story fully and completely. And you had just kind of quickly said, if I understand you correctly, the mortgage was like about $250,000. Is that correct?
It's over $250,000. But if they check the market value of my home right now, it probably lists at maybe $116,000.
Sure. So What is that about a monthly payment then if it's just over $250,000 for the mortgage?
I don't mind. Scratcher? I know everyone here is trying to help me and help the community and all that type of stuff. My mortgage payment is around $1,500.
Okay. And you said you're a single dad?
Yes.
I'm just calling you.
Sorry.
It's okay. I'm just calling you for the record. It just goes on the tape so they know who's talking.
And you said you're a single dad. And was that situation the same as when you took the mortgage?
Scratcher.
Okay, perfect. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for testifying today.
Thank you.
Okay, Madam Chair, next we have Reverend Chris Becker.
Welcome to the committee, Reverend Becker.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to speak about the crisis in people's lives around this housing issue. I am Pastor Chris Becker from Amazing Grace Lutheran Church in Invergrove Heights. My call and my vocation is to accompany people in life issues. And I will tell you that in the suburbs, foreclosures, we are not immune to foreclosures. And so I've been walking with people too many times in this issue, and I've been here before in the Capitol, pressing upon our elected leaders to do something about this foreclosure situation and crisis. The church has been known for being a step behind at times in this issue. It seems like we are again a little late because some people think that this housing crisis, has come and gone. I can assure you that in the case in the suburbs where I serve and where I live, as in the case of the major cities and outstate areas, foreclosures are not gone. I and the congregation I serve are part of Isaiah. Isaiah is a faith-based organization of churches in the Twin Cities and St. Cloud and other outstate areas that work at ways to take our faith and to use that faith in the public arena, such as today. Foreclosures call for us as people of faith to speak about one of our values, and that is compassion. The crisis of foreclosure is still alive and real in Dakota County. 6 years ago, one of our households from our congregation walked away from their home after they tried to find an alternative solution with their lender. There was a layoff from work, and it became harder and harder to pay their bills. They tried until no one seemed to listen, so they just stopped paying their mortgage, which I couldn't understand, and they walked away. In the last 2 years, in our small congregation, two other families, one recently who have joined, also have walked away from their homes, trying at first to find an alternative solution with their lenders. And yet they both discovered that their lenders were actively pursuing foreclosure steps while at the same time giving them somehow the impression that they were working with them to keep them in their homes. This state has recently that recognized that family structures have changed over the years. We've realized that whatever the household looks like, that there remains common family value. And one such value that we see is the stability a home provides. As a pastor whose spouse is an educator in the St. Paul School District, I cannot emphasize more how a stable home is vital to strong learning. I've heard for years from politicians this phrase, family values. It's been embedded in campaign slogans and sound bites. This bill allows us the opportunity in the state of Minnesota to act on behalf of what is crucial value for all families, a stable place to live. In the suburbs, this is a hidden shame. It is difficult to get people to reveal their guilt and shame around foreclosure. I'm a parish pastor, but I hold a degree in counseling, and I discovered that people are burdened with this guilt, that there are many out there who easily find ways to blame them because of a foreclosure. There's a lot of judgment out there. But as we all know, foreclosure is not simply about making poor decisions or overextending one's expenses. Foreclosures come because of no fault, loss of a job, or we now call it downsizing, a major health expense, divorce, military duty, and more. Mediation in this bill, as I see it, makes sense. It makes common sense. Mediation offers a healing process, face-to-face healing process, which now is broken. Mediation offers another way homeowners have to to explore options for staying in their home. Mediation is common sense. It's a win-win solution. I've talked to both Republicans and Democrats in my neck of the woods. People are able to remain in their homes and are provided with a stable place to live. Banks are not left with property that sits vacant, and property values in the neighborhood remain strong. So some may say that this is a complicated thing to do. I'm not a banker. Some say it's costly. If I ask you if we can save one family from disruption and crisis, is it worth it? If we can bring stability to the surrounding neighborhood so that others can thrive, is that worth it? If we can work together as elected leaders and community leaders to provide affirmation and support to people so that they can achieve their full potential, is that worth it? If we can create an environment where both lender and homeowner can resolve their differences face-to-face in a mediation process that brings a fruitful resolve, is that worth it? On behalf of hundreds of households, I urge you to pass this mediation bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Reverend Becker. Any questions? Representative Isaacs.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, it's not a question for the testifier. I have a question that I don't know how to address to another member. So I'll address it to you, and people can choose to answer if they want. Several times over the course of these hearings, I've heard when we've had people testify about their personal situation, a line of questioning that occurs that ends or includes if they were married when they first got the loan and now they're not. And I'm just interested in knowing why that's relevant, because I'm not saying it couldn't be relevant. I just don't know why it'd be relevant. And one of the representatives asked what his marital status was when he incurred the loan versus now, and I'm just trying to understand why that's relevant. That's all.
Okay.
Maybe you have the answer. I don't know.
I don't have the answer about why the representative asked it. I would guess, and there certainly couldn't be a response from that person. I would guess it has something to do with the cost of living for the individual. And how that has changed, but you know, I don't know. The person that asked the question, want to respond to the question? Yeah. I don't know. Is it Representative O'Neill? Sure.
Certainly. Well, I'm an accountant, and so I always look at all the numbers. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to know when you qualify for a loan, which I have done many. It's interesting, you know, it's important to know what the income was when you qualified for the loan, and I just really want to get a picture as to what his financial situation was and where it went, and so I could understand his testimony as to the relation to that and how he ended up in foreclosure.
Yeah, thank you. Representative Pertas, I think you had your hand up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think in response to Representative Isaacson's question, I was basically going along the same lines. Usually when people obtain a mortgage, they provide financial data or information that has stated income or proved income. And it's a legally binding contract, so I think the question is not prejudicial in terms of what your marital status is, but is more of a derivation of is it double income, and has your status changed to where it's single income, and is that perhaps what causes you to, you know, get into default? So I was just following up on what Rep. O'Neill said.
Thank you. Representative Isaacson?
That makes sense. I think that it would seem relevant to me then, if you're going to ask the question what the marital status was, to infer that there was a dual income, it would have been pertinent to ask the question of what he bought the house for at the time. And then ask what your mortgage value is now versus the value of how much the house is, if we're going to make a true understanding, if that's our intent. So for me, that'd be helpful to know in the future if that's relevant. I'm kind of new to the housing mortgage situation, so I'm legitimately asking a question I don't understand, and that's why, which you're not supposed to do as a politician, but I'm going to roll the dice on this one. But I think that on the outset, it didn't make sense to me why something that happened 15 years ago would be relevant to what's happening at this moment, but I don't always understand the mortgage process, so it's good to learn. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Becker, one of the issues you described was what we call dual tracking, where you have a bank working on the one hand with maybe one individual working with the homeowner, so the homeowner believes that they're working on a modification, and then there's another part of the banking company that's actually going forward with foreclosure. Now, we outlawed that last year in the bill that we passed, Homeowner Bill of Rights. And I'm just wondering if the recent, if the situation you talked about has been, I think what I understand from counsel, that took effect probably in January. So since then, I just want you to know that is a provision right now of state law. I don't know if that is continuing with some of your parishioners since early January, but it is a new law, and I'm just wanting you to know about it.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson. I recognize that. We were part of, as Isaiah congregations, we were part of urging that law to be passed. I believe that what I'm talking about now, especially in the recent member of our congregation, is that there wasn't an opportunity with a change in their status, whether it be marriage or job, that there wasn't an opportunity to do some mediation that, again, common sense comes back to my mind, that says, all right, when things change in life, and they do for many people, is there a process in which people then can engage in a face-to-face activity to offer other solutions in order for people to stay in their home? Healthcare, that's a big thing for people that I know of, that a major health illness all of a sudden allows them not to have the resources to pay their mortgage. Would the bank or lender be willing to work with the mediation process to offer some other options? Now, in some cases, that may not be. There may not be an option to stay in the home. But in some states that I know of, when they practice mediation, a large percentage of people are able to do that, and it offers the stability then not only for that family, but for the community, the neighborhood as well.
Okay, thank you. Representative Anderson?
Thanks again, Madam Chair. Pastor, thanks for being here. You mentioned you have a degree in counseling, so you're a good one to ask this question. Minnesota has a provision where counseling is offered in situations that we're talking about today. How do you see that fitting in with this new process of mediation, the value of one compared to the other, and is there a place or a need for both of these processes?
Reverend Becker. Or maybe the author?
Madam Chair, I can handle it. In the current bill that you have, we haven't spelled out the role of counselors, but it is our intent to have the counselors play a significant role in this process, so that the time of initial contact, a counselor will begin to be involved with that homeowner as well, and will hopefully, depending on how we get some funding streams and things like that, be able to go with them through the whole process up to mediation. So we see counselors still playing a critical role in this process, and the hope is current counseling is able to capture a certain number of individuals and to work with them. And through mediation, we believe that it might be another 10 to 15% more people might be able to stay in their homes as a result of this.
Yep. Sam Anderson? Okay. All right. Thank you very much, Reverend Becker.
I was just going to say next we have Sue Walla Phillips from MICA coming up.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Watlow Phillips.
Good afternoon, committee members. Madam Chair, Sue Watlow Phillips. I am the Interim Executive Director of MICA, the Metro Interfaith Council on Affordable Housing, and President and CEO of Integrated Community Solutions. I do have two handouts, if I may have.
Yes.
Folks,
pass
those out, please.
Okay. Thank you.
MICA and Integrated Community Solutions have supported the Home Ownership Bill of Rights and various versions of that over the last several years. And with the mediation section, we were very concerned when the bill passed without the mediation section last year. We strongly support this bill to provide homeowners the additional assistance to renegotiate and make the modification with their lender on their mortgage. Last year, we heard hours, I remember saying through hours, of banks and critics of the mediation section say, wait, we have new federal regulations that will address this issue. Those regulations are now in place. And Lord willing, the lenders will and hopefully will use those and may treat their customers fairly and negotiate in good faith a modification. If lenders do not, though, mediation provides an additional option and necessity for homeowners to have the mediator in that process. Now, the information that you're getting right now shows the number of foreclosures that we had across the state. You can look in your own constituency in regards to where those foreclosures are. And then you're getting another sheet that I just got an email on of foreclosures and people being able to buy them. These are your constituents' homes that people are buying because they've been in foreclosure. So I encourage you to think about this. These are our people in our community that are losing their homes. Now, if we would have passed this bill when the crisis first began in 2005, 2006, we would have helped 100,000 homeowners have mediation and not lose their homes potentially in Minnesota. In the eight-year history, I have this here, and I can probably pass out one of these if that would be helpful. We're seeing a decrease, and the latest studies even show that we're seeing even more of a decrease in the number of foreclosures in the country as well as in this state. But we are still 10,000 foreclosures higher than where we were at in 2005. So it's been my experience over 44 years in working with people at risk of experiencing homelessness that, and as a retired psychologist, that when people face losing their home, as the pastor just mentioned, they freeze, they procrastinate, they're in denial, they're in shame, they feel guilty that they've done something wrong and do not know where to turn for help. Now, in 2008 and 2009, when we were in the midst of the beginning of the growth of the crisis of homelessness, I wrote with the National Coalition Foreclosure to Homelessness, two national reports that had major impact on the federal legislation that we were able to pass, which helped significantly curb it. But what we continue to see is many, many low-income people that got into bad loans, many people of color that have been impacted and stripped of equity that now have these incredible debts because they got into horrible loans that were created at that time. So in Minnesota this year, we'll have 40,000 people experience homelessness. 46% of those will be children. This is according to the Wilder 2013 report. We allow anybody to experience homelessness. It's devastating to the individual, to the child, to the family, their ability to get a good education, to maintain a job. It's dangerous to their health. I spent hours at my church last night as we opened up our church facility in this very cold weather because we had 30 people that could have frozen to death last night. So it's incredibly costly to us as taxpayers. I mean, for us to have a family of three in a shelter is $3,000 a month. You can ask the banks in a few minutes and folks that are going to testify how much it costs if we go through foreclosure. Decrease in value, $25,000 or more per household. You look in your own neighborhoods or your own communities where there's a lot of foreclosures, and what are the values of the properties in those communities? This is incredibly important to all of us that we keep our constituents, our folks, in our own community in their homes so they can do well in the community. So as people of faith, is our hope and our prayer that our financial institutions do follow the rules of law, but also the golden rule. Not the rule of gold, but the golden rule. Treating others the way that we would want to be treated in that same situation. For those institutions that don't, we need this legislation to provide the mediation to protect our homeowners, our folks, in our communities. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions, comments from committee members? Representative Anderson.
Thank you again, Madam Chair. Ma'am, thanks for being here again. And in your testimony, I think I got it right here, you used a couple of times the term people got into bad loans and horrible loans. Could you describe what you mean by that?
Ms. Rutland Phillips.
Madam Chair, Representative, I have seen some of the loan documents that were given to folks, especially on the north side of Minneapolis in 2006, 7, and 8, and I am embarrassed that we would have any financial institution even provide that type of paperwork to folks. Things that could not be read by people that were being borrowed, we were loaned, they were loaning money to. I mean, the predatory type of lending that happened at that time, and a lot of that has been curbed by the federal legislation that we passed, as well as things that we've done here in the state of Minnesota. But I think that, you know, we should be very embarrassed about what happened during the middle of the last decade in regards to how we allowed our banks to operate and our financial institutions to operate.
Representative Anderson?
Just to follow up again, Madam Chair. So are you talking about, in these examples, terms that were unable to be met? Or, again, I don't know quite what you mean by horrible loan.
Okay.
Ms. Watlin-Phillips.
Madam Chair, Representative, if you recall that in 2006, 2007, when we had more limited looking at the actual application for a loan, you could say that you were making a certain amount of money, but you did not have to prove that. And you had lenders that would say, oh, well, you probably will make that in the next couple of months, so we're just going to go ahead and put this down on your application so you can get this house.
Ms. Wilson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And again, as you mentioned, too, have most of these or a lot of these situations or tactics been addressed and to whatever degree corrected by changes in previous law, federal law, as you mentioned?
Swallow-Phillips.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, that Congressman Ellison was very actively involved with us here in this state as well as around the country in helping to identify many of those practices as well as many other folks on the federal level.
Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Okay, we have some folks who would like to testify in opposition to the bill. And I think the first person is Kay Rucky Martin, I believe. Maybe you can help me say your name properly. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Martin.
Madam Chair, Representatives, my name is Kay Rucky. I'm the Martin County Recorder in Fairmont. I'm also the past president of the Minnesota County Recorders Association and immediate past president of the Property Records Industry Association, which is a business and government national standard-setting body for real estate. Roughly 10 years ago, the County Recorders Association was looking at our fees, our recording fees, and every county had a different type of recording fee. For all of the 400 to 500 document types that we get in on a daily basis, there were different recording fees. So we went and created, asked to have a law, actually, for the recording fees to create a standard flat recording fee, in which that pertains to every county in the state of Minnesota. We all have the same fee for all of those 400 and some documents. What this does is it keeps the buyer and the seller at the closing table knowing what every recording fee is going to be throughout the state of Minnesota. There's nothing hidden. It's consistent. And it also is very clear and transparent to that buyer and seller. It also is transparent for all of our title companies, which and closing companies, to attorneys, to other banks who work on a national basis and record documents in our offices. It was designed by the users. Basically, it covers all the county government offices were included in this, the Minnesota Land Title Association and other title companies, other Realtor Association, or the Realtor Association and other real estate associations, and the Minnesota State Bar Association. The flat recording fee is also a national model. It has been copied by other states, and it has been praised by other states and the IRS. South Dakota is a prime example of who has taken our recording fees and looked at them and passed legislation just this last year. The Internal Revenue Service records real estate documents in every state in the United States, and when they look at Minnesota's, they're very pleased that every time that they have to write a check out, it goes exactly at $46 in every county of the state of Minnesota. So the Minnesota County Recorders Association urges you to not look at the funding mechanism for this mediation bill from the recorder's office. We have worked very hard over the years to keep this consistent, and this would be a step backwards for us because it takes one document out of those 400 to 500 document types and opens a door that we would end up going back to the original way that we were recording documents. We know that there are other avenues and mechanisms to fund this mediation program, and that we urge you very strongly to keep the recording fees out of this plan and protect it for the public benefit and the success for consistency for our customers and our taxpayers. Thank you.
Question or comments from committee members? I want to see if I understand your testimony on one part. It sounds like the concern to have a consistency is really the basis. You don't want to go back to having many different fees. You want to have a consistent fee. Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair. An example would be the state of Massachusetts. We weren't quite as extreme, but we were heading down that road. If you were to record a deed in the state of Massachusetts, it could cost you $175. The next document is a mortgage. It would cost you maybe, say, $10. I don't know the exact figures. And then it would be $1 a page. And then you would record a mortgage satisfaction, and it would maybe be $5. If you're at a closing table, and if you're a buyer or a seller of property, and you look at those, how do you know exactly where you stand on those things? That's why we looked at the recording fee in Minnesota, because we did have that mortgage document that had, I believe it was a recording fee, and then it was $1 a page. We were literally sitting there counting pages of documents, which is ridiculous to have to do. But we don't want to go back to that situation again. And once we open up this door and the recording fees, it opens the door for any of those other 400 and some documents to be used.
I have a question. So it seems like going backwards might be a problem. You mentioned you thought there were some other sources of funding. Would you like to share that? We're always looking.
Yes, Madam Chair. There are probably other avenues that we've discussed. There is mortgage registration and deed tax, which the state already collects 97% of, and the counties get a 3% portion of that. That would be one avenue to probably look at if you're going down that road. I think the connection for documents and this mediation program might not be the best avenue, simply because it always goes back to that consumer, that buyer, that seller. They're always the ones that are paying for it anyway. So even if in this situation, if there was $300 added on to any type of document in the very end, if that property was foreclosed on, that goes into the cost and distribution costs on that foreclosure that the sheriff sets up, and who's paying for it? Well, the next person along the line is going to be paying for it. So it always is coming back to that buyer or that seller in this case.
So if I understand, your opposition is to the nature of the fee, not to the purpose of the bill.
Not the purpose of the bill,
thank
but
you.
To the fee tacked onto our
right.
Reporting fees.
Thank you. All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. Representative Dean? Okay. Oh, Representative Hertzoff, I'm sorry I didn't see your hand up. Did you want it for the witness? Okay, I'm sorry. If you could come back again. Ms. Recky.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for returning. I've been around real estate nearly all of my life. And not very long ago, at least in my recollection, recording fees were $16.50. Then they went to $22.50. Then they were as high as $64.50, depending on county. And now it's $46.50. Having to record in real estate transactions an affidavit of owner, affidavit oftentimes of buyer and seller in terms of who they are. Sometimes they have a common name. Having junior liens or mortgages in a refinance. Having all of these different documents adds hundreds of dollars to a real estate transaction. And I guess I'm getting a little off track, but really what justification is there for a $46.50 recording fee?
Representative, we're funded through county government, but the recording fee offsets those costs. The recording fee actually is $46, but the county gets $35.50. The $10.50 goes to the state general fund. So we are getting $35.50 for that document, and that document covers, it goes into a technology fund. So our offices are state of the art, basically, as far as technology. Our turnarounds are faster. Turnaround make a big difference as far as buying and selling property. and getting those documents a public record, which is extremely important to have public record, which is the base of our economy for buying and selling property in the United States. So there have been recording fees. I believe when I started, it was $15, and I started 28-some years ago. So, and it hasn't really gone up. It stayed at $19.50, of which the state had $4.50 of that. So it stayed at $15 for, I believe, close to 20 years. And so when we worked on this flat fee bill, we worked on some mechanisms to help the technology in our county government and to speed up this customer service, and then to also keep this consistent flat fee so everybody was aware of what those were.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. So what you've said then is really the recording fees also include essentially a 25% tax, about $10.50 of that $46 fee is a tax that goes to the general fund.
Madam Chair, Representative.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, any other comments, questions? All right, thank you very much for your testimony. Myra Humphrey is the next person I have on the list. Welcome to the committee, Sumphrey.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mara Humphrey. I'm the Vice President, Governmental Affairs for the Minnesota Credit Union Network. The Minnesota Credit Union Network represents the state's 134 credit unions all around the state. I appreciate the opportunity to come and give comments on the bill here today. Credit unions really strive to serve their members in the best possible way and help them make financial decisions that positively impact their future. Credit unions are definitely very concerned about foreclosures and support fixes that will make the burden less, both on credit unions but also on their members. As people-centered, community-based financial institutions, we have a personal relationship with our members and want to make sure that we can continue that lifelong relationship. We don't view a mortgage as doing a one-time transaction. We view it as a long continuum of a process of a lot of financial services we offer to that member. So walk into a mortgage and want to make sure it's something that the member can afford to pay back. We do expect that we're going to give them a product that they can afford to pay back, as well as we want to make sure that we can provide them with the other services that they need to secure a good financial future. The Minnesota Credit Union Network and Minnesota credit unions have worked hard over the past 7 years on solutions to the Minnesota foreclosure problem. I'm really proud of some of the changes we've made, including the law that was passed last year. I think it addresses a number of the issues and provides a number of remedies for consumers, for credit union members going through the process. We definitely don't want to foreclose. No one wants to have a house. No one wants the homeowner, the credit union member, to be out of a house. But unfortunately, there are cases where we do have to go through the legal process. I would just want you to know that credit unions don't take that process lightly. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to the author recently, express some of our concerns, and look forward to the opportunity to work with him. I did want to share with you some of our specific concerns that we had when we walked through this bill. One of the concerns that we had deals with counseling. We're really concerned about how the counseling process in Minnesota law fits into the time frame and the process. We don't really want to see the current counseling process get minimized or pushed aside by the pieces of the mediation. And I guess it really isn't clear to us how they all fit together and how what the role that the counseling is serving. I pulled out the number from the most recent Minnesota Homeownership Center report. They found that 47% of homeowners receiving counseling were able to avoid foreclosure. And I think that really speaks to how effective the counseling component has been through the foreclosure process. A number of credit unions also partner with Lutheran Social Services, who are able to provide not only foreclosure counseling, but counseling in general, anytime a member wants to sit down, work on their budget. And it really is able to give them a broader perspective, not only the targeted, I can't make my payment this month look, but really to sit down and look at their finances overall to make sure that they can afford every payment that they're making and that they're going to be moving in the right direction financially. Another issue that I want to address is the small financial institution exemption. We definitely appreciate the exemption that is included in this bill. It exempts financial institutions who have under 150 or fewer foreclosure filings in a year. However, we really don't feel that it goes far enough in terms of the breadth or the scope of the exemption. I want to give you a couple of examples of where the smaller financial institutions are still really getting pulled in. One of the examples is, as we read the bill, everyone's going to be required to pay this additional $300 filing fee, whether you're going to be going into mediation or not. Another example is, under the bill, it fails to exempt the smaller financial institutions from the several requirements that we are currently exempted from under the CFPB small servicer requirements, and that we are also exempted from under the Minnesota Homeowners Bill of Rights that was passed last session. And I think those exemptions for financial institutions really acknowledge the fact that we don't have the resources that some larger financial institutions might have. One of them specific is naming a single point of contact. And the reason why we have been exempt for that is because it hasn't been an issue for credit unions and for some of the smaller financial institutions. I think one of the advantages of being smaller, we're local, you can walk into the local branch. It hasn't been a problem to find the right person. I'll submit, in many credit unions, there may only be a point of contact. But having to name one, and there's a number of additional regulatory requirements that go along with that, we're definitely concerned about that burden. Another concern that we have with the bill is the impact on second lien holders. We have big concerns of the impact this will have. It requires a new requirement that all second lien holders also go into mediation. Second lien holders are a large part of credit unions' portfolios, and it's something that they keep in-house. The ability to strip the second liens would definitely have a devastating impact, especially on smaller credit unions. The requirement that all second lien holders attend mediation, I'm concerned about how resource intensive this is going to be for credit unions. I think it also doesn't acknowledge some of the geographic disparities of different areas. And just we have several concerns about procedurally how that's going to work and the number of pieces in it. In addition, overall in the bill, we just have a number of technical and procedural concerns with how this bill operate and fit into the current foreclosure process and time frame. I'd be happy to discuss specifics further, but really wanted to get across our larger concern just about the intent, purpose, and applicability of this bill to credit unions. Minnesota credit unions view foreclosure as a last resort. They want to keep those members for life so that they can help them make the best financial decisions possible. We definitely don't enter into the decision to foreclose lightly. We're proud of the work that has been done over the past several years on the Minnesota statute to ensure that homeowners have strong rights and protections through the process. We also appreciate the efforts of the chair and the committee's efforts to look at increasing home ownership. I think we've been very focused on this narrow scope of foreclosures, but there's also a broader look at what can we do to increase home ownership? What can we do to increase financial literacy? All those tools that we need to have in place to ensure that we have successful Minnesota homeowners. So, thank you for the opportunity to express some of my concerns about the bill. Look forward to having continued discussions with both the committee and the author. I'd be happy to take any questions from the committee.
Thank you, Ms. Humphrey. Any questions, comments from committee members? If not, thank you. Next, we have Tess Rice, Minnesota Bankers Association. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Rice.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. Sorry, I've got a cold. My name is Tess Rice. I'm general counsel for the Minnesota Bankers Association. We represent about 95% of the banks in Minnesota. That's about 360 banks, from the very largest to the very smallest community banks. Since 2007, we've worked collaboratively with stakeholders on 29 different bills on foreclosure with 91 different provisions to strengthen foreclosure laws in Minnesota for the consumer. Last year's foreclosure bill was called the strongest homeowner bill of rights in the country by the advocates. It bans dual tracking of foreclosures, meaning loan servicers can't sell off a home unless there's a clear yes or no on a person's loan modification application. It also explicitly requires banks and servicers to make loan modifications to everyone who is eligible and assist them with the process. The bill contains a private right of action where the foreclosure sale may actually be set aside, or if it hasn't happened yet, it can be stopped and attorney's fees awarded to the consumer if the servicer isn't following the rules in the statute. It gives homeowners more time to seek a loan modification. They have up until the seventh day before the foreclosure sale to apply for a modification. And the process will be stopped then until a decision is made, and there is an appeals process as well that they can go through for the loan modification. Our general policy concerns with the bill include that state law that just passed last year was just effective 6 months ago. The federal servicing rules from the CFPB, the Community Financial Protection Agency, those became effective in January, 2 weeks ago. And we believe those laws should be given the opportunity to work before new laws are added to the process. We have one of the strongest foreclosure counseling programs in the nation. Every borrower in foreclosure is eligible for free counseling and is informed of that service multiple times during the foreclosure process. This counseling is conducted by nonprofits with trained and certified advisors who provide free non-biased services, and they'll review a borrower's whole financial situation and then work as an advocate for the borrower with the mortgage company to try to find the best solution to their problem. The foreclosure process is already long and confusing, and we're not clear right now how mediation will fit into that process and how it will work with the foreclosure counseling. We know that the mediation process will take at least 4 months the way the bill is written right now, but it could take substantially longer. I have a visual aid that shows what notices consumers receive now in the foreclosure process. So when a foreclosure is happening, let's say if the borrower is 30 days late, they're going to get this notice. Thank you. They'll receive a notice from the servicer that they're in default and that foreclosure could occur. And typically sent at that time, not required to be sent at that time, but sometime soon, is the pre-foreclosure notice, and that lets them know about pre-foreclosure foreclosure counseling and gives them contact information. The servicer will also let that foreclosure counseling agency know about this borrower in foreclosure, and the foreclosure counseling agency will contact them directly.
Yep. Could you move your microphone over? We just want to make sure we can hear you. There you go. Thank you.
At 36 days, delinquent. So if a customer is 36 days late, federal law requires the servicer to make live contact with the borrower to let them know you're in default and these are your options. At 45 days, notice must be sent. This is under federal law, letting them know that there are loan modification alternatives available, giving them a single point of contact, and then information again about housing counseling. Contact information. If the person is a service member, they'll get an additional notice at that time, letting them know about the protections of the Service Members Civil Rights Relief Act. And then after that, there will be another notice. And these four at the bottom will come at the same time in different colors. And they will get another notice. This will be personally served, letting them know that that there is help for them when they're in foreclosure, and giving them contact information again for foreclosure counseling. And then there will be a notice that lets them know about redemption. So if they do go through the foreclosure sale, what their rights are to redeem the property. There's also a notice about their homestead, and then finally the notice of foreclosure sale. So they will be receiving all of those notices. Under the bill, there would be three additional notices that would go to the consumer. So a notice, what happens is the lender will let the OAH know that they're going to start the foreclosure process. OAH will then send out a date for the mediation. They'll determine what that date is, and they will send the notice out to the homeowner. So I think it have to be at least 45 days delinquent, so somewhere around this time this notice would come. And then the bank is required to send a notice to the homeowner in another color, and that'll probably be somewhere around 45 days as well. And that will explain to them about mediation. And then there isn't really a timeline for this, but the OAH would send a homeowner an opt-out of mediation form. So if they choose not to go to mediation, sometime during this process, they will also receive this form. So there are many opportunities during this process for a homeowner to know about financial counseling that's available.
And if these rules are not followed, they have the opportunity to get them enforced either through state law with the private right of action or with the CFPB and the bank regulators. So there are different options for that. So we're not really clear how there is any benefit provided over the foreclosure counseling. And mainly that's because when you look at the list of what a mediator does, it's exactly what a foreclosure counselor does. The bill requires lenders to act in good faith. It creates serious repercussions if they don't. But there's no commensurate risk on the part of anyone else, not the homeowner and not the mediator. So the homeowner is going to receive this notice of mediation and have the opportunity to opt out of it, but they don't have to open it, they don't have to read it, but we have to be there. So the banks will be at that mediation, the mediator will be there with no indication that the borrower will come. And there's also no indication that they will be prepared for that mediation. And so this could be a very long, drawn-out process, and there could be a lot of wasted time and money because banks will probably have to bring an attorney with them for the mediation as well. And the costs of that, as well as a $300 fee, will, be passed on to consumers. As mentioned, lien holders of second and subsequent mortgages have to appear at the mediation as well. And if they don't, or if the mediator determines that they didn't act in good faith, their lien can be voided. So the homeowner can go, file an affidavit, and that lien is wiped out. So there are very, very serious repercussions, and the mediator has all the authority to do these things, but there's no checks and balance on the mediator's conduct here. The Office of Administrative Hearings is authorized to adopt rules to carry out these provisions of the bill, but the bill says that they don't have to follow the administrative procedure rules in doing so, and we're concerned about that as well, because that means no public hearings have to occur, and there's no opportunities for the public to comment, and no review by an administrative law judge. We have a lot of other policy concerns with it, as well as some technical issues with the bill. We've come to the legislature year after year working collaboratively with those seeking to improve Minnesota's foreclosure laws. We now have some of the most consumer-friendly foreclosure laws in the country, and we believe that some of these laws are so new that they should be given the time to work before we add another layer of bureaucracy to the system. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Humphrey. Any questions, comments? Representative Isaacson?
I'm going to hold off just for a moment.
Oh, okay. Representative Carlson?
Madam Chair, Ms. Rice, you indicated that several forms had gone out before you referenced a single point of contact. And my question is, why wouldn't that notification of a single point of contact be earlier in the process? I would think earlier the better. And we had a high profile case in my former district before redistricting that one of the major issues was that very point about single point of contact. Mm-hmm. And so I would think you'd want to do that much earlier than in the process than what you seem to indicate when you were going through the various forms on your chart there. If you could comment on that.
Madam Chair, Representative, the requirement for assigning a single point of contact is 45 days delinquent, so a borrower just needs to be late by 45 days for that to be assigned. There will also be that phone call at 36 days delinquent with someone from the servicer to talk to them about loan modification options. So it's 45 days. I mean, a lot of people are able to catch up during that time, so I don't think they wanted to do it immediately. This was the CFPB. And they must have determined that that's when it's serious enough to need to appoint someone.
Madam Chair, I understand what you're saying in terms of the 45 days, but once there's the signal there that there may be a potential problem, my personal opinion would be that the bank would be better off letting them know very early in the process or almost immediately who they should contact, and then that would be the person that they would continue to work with as you go through the various legal requirements on when notice would be made. I'm just pointing out, Madam Chair, that was a very big issue with a foreclosure in my old district. In fact, it had a lot of media attention and so on at the time. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Isaacson, did you want to go now? Or
I'm going to hold off for a moment.
Okay. I do have a question. So in this bill, Representative Dean has the single point of contact language here, and my understanding is, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the federal single point of contact can change, even though it's called a single point of contact. And I think what this bill does is say that single point of contact would be in place throughout the process. Isn't that a distinction between what the federal requirement is and what this bill does? And I'm not sure if I've got that right, Representative Dean, but I'm wondering if I do, and maybe you can tell me.
Madam Chair, there probably is a distinction. It's a team that needs to be assigned at the federal level. I think the CFPB had some understanding about employees not going on vacation or, you know, transferring out or quitting, and that could be somewhat fluid, and so they suggested assigning an entire team. A bank is free to assign a single person if they choose to do so.
And then I guess my other question was kind of along the line of Representative Carlson brought it to mind. I was thinking about the individual who testified earlier that she was told that she needed to wait until she was in default. She couldn't get any services for any sort of modification until then. And then is it your opinion that with that kind of advice, that if it still continues, that the single point of contact would kick in at what point?
Madam Chair, it's not going to kick in until they're 45 days late. Maybe Representative Dean could answer better on his bill as to what would happen. I don't have it in front of me.
Representative Dean.
Madam Chair, members, as the bill is currently stated, we see the process kicking in after the initial pre-foreclosure notice that goes up. We haven't set the exact date, although we do outline after that 45 days has transpired that this notice would then begin the process. And as Ms. Rice had put forward, this is something that's going to happen simultaneously. It's not something that's happening in addition to. So the hope is that, you know, the mediation will be able to transpire within a three-month period, so that it won't be adding lots of time onto the process. And at that point in time, you know, the bank is always welcome to continue working with the homeowner to try to reach some type of agreement loan modification. So ultimately, you know, the banks do have a participatory role in this process prior to the beginning of mediation. Now, should they not be able to reach an agreement, that's when mediation kicks in. And to that point, you know, we do know that in many other states that have tried mediation, the success rate has been very, very high, in excess of 50% of those people that enter into mediation.
Thank you. So just to clarify, and maybe you could tell me if this, Ms. Rice, if this is continuing practice, but the requirement that an individual stop their mortgage payment before they can begin any sort of remediation, does that seem like a good idea? Is that common practice? I'm just wondering. It's not like we had testifiers who would have liked to have gotten help with some sort of modification earlier, but they were required to put themselves in a very vulnerable spot. And is that common practice that continues, or what kind of information can you tell us about that? Do we need to address that in law somewhere?
Madam Chair, it was, I think, fairly common back in probably 2007, 8, 9, perhaps. Now there are programs established where you do not have to be in default. I mean, many of the government modification programs required that you be in default. Now there are some that don't. So it's a matter of which programs you can qualify for. And I don't know that they had any programs at that time that you could qualify for without being actually in default.
Okay, so I think what I'm hearing is there are opportunities, but there's not a law that limits that. There are more opportunities for the, hopefully, but a bank that would choose to do that could still do it. There's no prohibition against it. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
All right, thank you. Representative Dean?
Madam Chair, and as someone who was in financial hardship several years ago with their mortgage, when we called the bank, they said, well, there's nothing we can do for you until you miss a payment. So we didn't miss a payment, by the way.
right, thank you. Well, thank you very much, Ms. Rice, for your... Oh, Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. again, learning curve here, so I'm just trying to figure some stuff out. When you say this 45 days, is that... is there a business reason why you'd wait 45 days? Or what's the purpose of that? Why wouldn't we have that sooner? Why doesn't it benefit everybody to have that sooner?
Madam Chair, Representative, that was a point in time that mm-hmm. the federal government decided that someone is now in a serious situation.
Sure.
And it makes sense to give them the notice. Mm-hmm. There could be information contained in a 30-day default notice. Mm-hmm. That one is required by state law, and there is information about contact things in there. But the federal government and in this bill has decided, I think, that a 45 days is probably the earliest where you can really think that someone
perfect.
Foreclosure
Thank you.
May be likely.
I have one more question.
Representative Isaacson.
Thank you. And then why is it required that... Why would the bank want it to be a deal where you wouldn't qualify or be able to get a modification until you're in default? I kind of get a little bit of why you would want to make sure someone was serious that they needed it and they weren't just trying to get out of a lower interest rate. But I think my question would be is that it seems like if you had folks who are trying to make a good faith effort by contacting you in advance, we would want to reward someone taking the initiative and responsibility. And so I'm just wondering, why do we have to wait? Do you know what the reasoning is behind that from the bank point of view?
Madam Chair, Representative, there isn't any requirement that they wait. The requirement just relates to the notice. So they've got to call by the 36th day delinquent let them know about options, but they don't have to provide that notice until 45 days. There's no reason to wait, though.
I wasn't clear. I switched gears on you there, and I apologize. I started halfway through my thought there. When it comes to applying for a modification to your loan, we've heard testimony that said that you needed to be in default before you could qualify for the modification. And I think that what I'm asking is, why do we have to wait till they're in default if someone's making a good faith effort?
Madam Chair, Representative, mm-hmm. I don't believe that is the case anymore.
So that's
there are programs that are available for people who are not currently in default.
And that's through the bank or other programs?
Well, they're federal programs.
Right. Okay.
If a bank had programs, that they
right.
can make up their own programs.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I just want to make sure I understand that. Like I said, I'm learning as we go. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I think we have
one more.
David Skillbred, the Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota. Welcome to the committee. Mr. Skillbred.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is David Skillbred. I'm the Vice President of Government Relations for the Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota, the statewide association of privately held community banks. These are your small banks that you see on Main Street almost in every town that you go through in this state. And they are banks that are often third, fourth, fifth generation. And they are banks where they don't move. They stay there. We've got a lot of banks over 100 years old. And the people who own the banks and work in the banks are also the people that live in the communities with the people that they serve. I want to thank you for just making a few comments. The previous comments made by Ms. Rice and the credit unions are very, very good. I want to, there was a comment made about the current climate of the housing, compared to the past, and it has improved and has improved significantly. An article by the Star Tribune dated 114 said that according to Care Logic, the number of Minnesota homeowners who are seriously delinquent fell to just 2.7%, which is half the national average. Now, for those folks, it's a tough deal. But the point is that things are improving, and it's our opinion that this bill would hinder the improvement of the real estate market. Secondly, a couple of technical difficulties, challenges. I'd like to just quickly do. Number one, the fee was noticed and talked about previously, and my question also was if you are exempt by the low exemption, do you pay the fee? And do homeowners have any responsibility in paying a portion of that fee or anything else down the road? It looks to me like that is not. Section 10, line 8.4, states a lender who fails to provide a reasonable explanation for not agreeing to loss mitigation is not negotiating in good faith. Who determines reasonability? Is that the mediator's role? It's very vague and subjective, and that concerns us greatly. Also, contradictory to that statement is the line on 8.9 and through 8.10. That line says, the bill proposes that failure by a lender to modify a loan is not in itself lack of good faith. Now that line, I believe, comes from the statutes of the Minnesota Farmer Lenders statutes, because that's in there identically or else very, very close. But those two lines in the bill appear to me that they don't really go together. On lines 5.16, it requires and lists a number of things, and Ms. Rice referenced this. I'll just add one more thing. It requires and lists a number of things that banks must send to the homeowner. This to us is problematic. What information needs to be included? If something is not included, does that void the disclosure? It seems to us that the better idea would be to have a list of items that the borrower sends to the bank, and those obviously would be the things that you normally would use when you go through an underwriting process and apply for a new loan. Tax returns, W-2s, sources of income, because that's exactly what's going to have to be talked about at the mediation. And if you don't tell the homeowner exactly what to bring, they may not bring things that are worthy and things that are helpful for that discussion. With respect to the mediation itself, it seems to us that with mediation requires two parties to give up something and compromise. And here in politics, where there's caucuses and two bodies, and we have a process called a conference committee, we get that. Our question is, how does this work for homeowners and lenders? In the farmer-lender mediation situation, farmers are businesses, and they have assets. So if they have an unpaid bill and they sit down with their lender, they can agree that some livestock be sold, some land be sold, something be sold in order to come up with some cash in order to help their side of the equation. And then in exchange, the bank can do something on their behalf so that both give up something. And in this bill, it doesn't look as if there's a responsibility on both sides. And I really saw this when I read line 6.3. It's one line within one of the notices that the lender is required to send to the homeowner. And the line reads that when the homeowner attends mediation, quote, an agent of the lender, unquote, will be there to negotiate and modify the terms of your loan. This sounds to me like a promise, a declaration. This is what you get. And in my mind, the mediation has no guarantee. It's just a process that hopefully will garner something positive. And then finally, this would provide one mediation, and it's questionable to us what one mediation would actually accomplish. When my lenders have a problem like this, we typically wait 90 days and work with the homeowner for 90 days in order to try to come to some sort of solution. And if no solution is available, and typically the problem is not solvable because it's caused by a loss of job, it's caused by an illness, a combination of both, a divorce, etc. If at that point in time we see no possibility of a resolution, it's only then that we finally go into the foreclosure process. There's no effective date on this bill. I just want to mention that. And finally, there's some talk about the federal legislation that has been passed and now is becoming effective. The definition of a qualified mortgage just was released by the Financial Services Bureau 2 weeks ago, Friday. There's a lot happening. And the way that we see this is that the restrictions placed on lenders that are coming down the pike are very strict, and we're going to have to be within those guidelines if we want to send those mortgages to the secondary market, Fannie and Freddie. And if they are outside those guidelines, then we're going to have to hold them in, and then this bill would apply. And what the result of that is, if you add the risk of this bill to that sort of situation, those folks that are kind of on the bubble, they might not get that loan. So in our minds, it doesn't help the people that it's trying to help, and in fact is very likely going to harm lower income and middle income people, especially in urban areas and rural areas. With that, I'll conclude my testimony, and thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, maybe more a comment, and as I look around the room, you and I were here when the farmer lender program was set up. I was on the Financial Institutions and Insurance Committee at the time, and I also happened to chair the Education Division of Appropriations. And both those committees dealt with the issue. You might say, well, what did the Education Division of Appropriations have to do with it? Well, we had the budget for the extension program at the University of Minnesota. And the magnitude is here is quite a bit different, you know, and just in terms of the sheer numbers of people that you would want to engage in mediation. But that did work quite successfully once it was in place. To use a current term, a lot of those farms were what we would call underwater, but the typical testimony, a family farm or a family that was operating a farm would come forward, and it was often the husband and wife, and just the way many of them operated, he would be in charge of the field and what have you, and she would be doing the bookwork, so they'd come up together. And the one thing I'll always remember was that they said, we've made every single payment on our farm. But the problem was, and that's why I say there's some parallels and some differences, was that they had purchased farmland at a higher price than what it was currently worth. And of course, then the local banker was often forcing them into an auction situation where they would have to get their, I think the term was debt to asset ratio in place, and that meant that they had to come one way or another up with a lot of cash. Hence, you had to mediate that kind of an issue, but a very difficult period, and the testimony from those farm families is very similar to what we heard earlier here today in terms of the magnitude of the problem and how you resolve it. Maybe an area that the committee could take a look at in terms of how we address that, but at any rate, I just thought I'd share some of that history with the committee. And you were shaking your head, yes, Madam Chair. In fact, where you grew up, that was one of the hotbeds of the issue of farm foreclosure out in southwestern Minnesota.
It was, Mr. Chairman. We had a very active community response. I remember the day that the tractors and others arrived at the Capitol, drove around and let us know how important it was, and they also made long streamers of foreclosure notices and lowered them from the second tier down to the floor. It was a very effective communication symbol. A lot of suffering. And I think the kind of suffering we're talking about here is certainly no less. So I guess...
the main point I wanted to make was the important value of having a system of mediation so that
exactly, and it worked.
The debtor and the creditor can work out their differences. And that was the parallel, the problem that they were having and the problem that the people here today that testified are having. And that became very, very important during the farm crisis of the 1980s. But I'll just stop there. I just wanted to make a comment. I wasn't necessarily looking for a response.
Sure. Mrs. Gilbert, it looks like you have a response.
Madam Chair, thank you. Just a couple of comments. I remember that day in 1986 when the farmers came to the Capitol. I believe that there were 10,000 farmers that were here, an unbelievable amount of activity, which was parallel and, of course, related to the issue at hand. Number two, there are some differences and there's some similarities, absolutely. In all, I think that it's kind of apples and oranges, because a lot of the loans that the homeowners are referring to are owned by some bank, financial lender on the East Coast or whatever, and then the servicers are the ones that are in charge of that. In the homeowner and the farmer lender issue, my community banks and the Farm Credit Agency, we were the two big lenders of those farm loans. So walking into the bank was no problem to see, to begin talking, and those talks could go on forever, and most of the time, a lot of the time, things work. And finally, there's no effective date on this, or a sunset, and there was no sunset on the 86 bill, and that was due to some court cases that prohibited that sort of a law from being made permanent, and therefore it was made temporary, and every couple of years we extend the law, and so now in 2014 the law is still in existence, even though in 86 when they passed it, the idea of the authors and the legislature was that it would expire in 1988.
Okay, and I would just also could probably indicate that there was bank opposition to the mediation law then when it passed too, quite a bit of opposition. That's why there was so much outpouring. But thank you very much for your testimony. I really appreciate it. Unless there's other questions, we have two more witnesses, and we have just time for two more witnesses, and I think we should forward. So, Julie, we've been notified, Julie Gagnon and then Mike Davey, and I think with that we'll wind up our testimony for today. So, Julie Gagnon, you want to come down first? I think I said your name wrong, Julie Gugan.
It's all right, I've heard it all.
Welcome.
My
to
name
the
is
committee.
Julie Gugan. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Home Ownership Center. My organization is the statewide nonprofit intermediary that coordinates foreclosure prevention counseling services in every county in the state of Minnesota. I can't stress enough how unique our approach is in Minnesota to foreclosure prevention counseling. In no other state in the country is universal access available to counseling in a coordinated and standardized way. So our role with our homeownership counseling agencies is to propagate programs that are delivered through nonprofit agencies and some government-based agencies around the state in a uniform fashion. So any consumer in Minnesota, regardless of income, has access to free foreclosure prevention counseling services. Since the start of the foreclosure counseling, since the start of the foreclosure crisis, we've worked with over 70,000 Minnesota households. Last year, we worked with, in 2013, we worked with 4,200 households, which is down from our high of about 16,000 households in 2008 and 2009. So clearly, we're seeing a downturn in the foreclosure crisis, but nevertheless, those 4,200 households facing foreclosure are facing real crisis. I do want to emphasize that the work that our foreclosure counselors do is efficient and effective. It costs approximately $450 per household to provide our foreclosure counseling services. The services are free to the consumer. The cost is paid through grants and government programs. And our counseling services are effective. I believe somebody who testified before me quoted a 47% success rate, and that's about right. It goes anywhere from 47 to 52% in any given year. We have worked really hard over the last several years to formulate partnerships with servicing entities and mortgage investors to help make the foreclosure prevention process easier for consumers. It's a big part of what we do is try and formulate ways to work directly with the servicers. Counselors are trained and certified and are part of a professional network of individuals who understand the myriad of programs that are available to consumers and the myriad of options. The goal of counseling is to create a sustainable plan for the household to stabilize their housing for the long term. We don't look at the short term issues, we look at a long term approach. That's the ideal. So the actual action plan that gets put in place varies from household to household depending on the household situation, marital status, employment situation, income in the household, expenses in the household, desire to remain in the household are all factors that are taken into account when the action plan is created. We have met with Representative Dean. Appreciate the opportunity to talk about this bill. Currently, our organization is relatively neutral on the concept of mediation, other than to say if we are to pass the optimum mediation bill, there should be very definitive involvement from the highly evolved network of foreclosure prevention counselors here in the state of Minnesota. And I appreciate Representative Dean's willingness to talk with us some more about that and what that language might look like. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Guggen, any questions, comments from members? Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And thank you for your testimony. Shed some light on the success, I think, of what you're doing. And I guess this is just my opinion, but it would seem to me that what you're doing is working at least 50% of the time. And I'm not so sure the mediation, I think Representative Dean talked about another 10 or 11%, 15, whatever. But I guess in my mind, I'm not so sure that this extra layer is necessary. That's my point.
Okay. All right, thank you. Any other comments? Okay, we have another witness, Mike Davey. Thank you very much for your
testimony. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Davey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, again, my name is Mike Davey. I'm an attorney in private practice, and I work for the law firm of Chitwood and Davey. I'm a bankruptcy attorney, and so I've taken time out of my day to come down here to talk to all of you about why I think mediation is a good idea. I've got a number of clients that would have benefited from mediation, simply being able to cut through the paperwork nightmare, to be honest. You get the homeowner and someone who can speak and make decisions on behalf of the creditor, the lender, in a room working through a mediator, able to resolve a problem. I think that, in a nutshell, is one of the reasons why I think mediation would be a good thing in the state. In the Western District of Wisconsin, the bankruptcy court there has established a mediation program. And I've got a client who, for 8 months, went back and forth and completed paperwork. She completed the request for mortgage assistance paperwork 19 times for Bank of America because it kept getting misplaced. And eventually she said, can we just try something else? And I said, well, let's try this new mediation program that exists in the Western District of Wisconsin. She did, and it took the law firm that Bank of America had retained, it took them about 2 weeks, and they made a decision, yeah, let's do that. I think that's a good idea. I think everyone will benefit. And so she's now in the process of actually working through a process where the creditor is going to sit down with the mediator and with my client, and they're actually going to be able to negotiate and resolve a situation that hopefully is going to work to the benefit of everyone rather than kind of this continuing back and forth. And lest we think this is a client I was working with 3 years ago, this is a client that I'm working with today. So even after all that evolution of, well, there was that big national settlement and, you know, mortgage banks are much better about and services are much better about not losing paperwork and keeping track and a single point of contact, it's still happening today. And so creating this extra layer in there, this extra layer of protection, I think benefits everyone, both the creditors and the homeowners, because the creditors have said and testified they don't want to take homes back if they don't need to. Well, let's avoid that paperwork loss problem. Let's get two people, both parties in the room who can negotiate and actually solve the problem, talking through a mediator. The other thing I want to bring up is I worked with a veteran, late 50s, here in the state of Minnesota. And he received this notice in February of 2013 from his mortgage company, and they said, we understand how difficult it may be to ask for help, but we're here to help you. We want to know you have options. So he completed the paperwork. Then on April 8th, he gets a letter. You know, we recently received a request for a traditional loan modification. We are not able to fulfill your request at this time for the following reasons. The investor or master servicer of your loan have not provided us any authority to modify your loan. But so he's confused at this point. He's thinking, well, so I guess I can't get help. But he gets another letter in June saying, we need some additional documents to complete your review of your request for a loan modification. He's thinking, well, I thought I got a letter back in April. Again, this is just last year, again, after that big national settlement. And so he goes through, and I just want to read a little bit about what his problem was. And there was several people testifying about what are homeowners giving up? You know, where's their skin in the game in this mediation bill? I think it's important for us to not forget that people like my client, he liquidated 100% of his life savings to try and keep his house when he lost his job in April of 2010. He lost his job. He said, I get unemployment, but was a big cut in pay when I lost my job in April of 2010. I worked for LensCrafters for 13 years. Between April 2009 and April 2010, I made $52,000. But on unemployment, it reduced it to $22,000. He then writes that he was no longer able to make his mortgage payments, and he simply wanted some help. He simply wanted the mortgage company to, in effect, re-age his loan because he had eventually found work, and they said, no, we're not going to re-age your loan. This foreclosure didn't need to happen. This could have been completely avoided just by simply avoiding this paperwork. And so this was in July of last year. And he's thinking, all right, so they're not going to do it. But then again, he gets a letter later in July, saying that, well, you know, your loan's at risk of going into foreclosure. Then in August 19th, he receives another letter basically saying, it's not too late to be considered for a solution, but it is important that you act now. A financial analysis packet has been sent in a separate mailing. And then he gets that dated August 21st. We understand how difficult it may be to ask for help when you need it most. We want to know that you are here to help. And he took out a loan with a company that specializes in servicing the needs of veterans. But when he needed help, after he liquidated his assets, I think it would be hard-pressed for any of us to say he didn't throw everything he had at trying to save his home. When he needed help, where were we? And I think it's clear that something more needs to be done. I actually dithered about whether or not I was going to testify today, because I thought, I wish we would have done this in 08, before we had 100,000 homeowners. Maybe only 15% of them we could have saved. That's 15,000 people that would still be housed today in their own homes. And I guess the reason I decided to testify was when I talked to my client yesterday, he says, well, I guess come April of this year, I'm going to need to find a new home, and I don't know what I'm going to do. He doesn't have, he lives alone, he's got a dog, and he's worried about his dog, and he's worried about what he's going to do. He's kind of, and I think we owe it to people like him who struggle, who are trying to do everything in their power to save their home, to give them this one other option, to allow them to be able to sit down in a room, creditor, homeowner, and be able to attempt to negotiate a resolution of this. It's not going to work in every case. I have plenty of clients that I explain to them where it's not going to work. They just don't have the income, but a lot of them they do. And it's just, it's lost paperwork, or it's this, or it's that. And it's so much easier. We all know it's so much easier if you can get someone on both ends who can commit and resolve the situation to be able to sit down and actually do that. And so that's why I think this is incredibly important. Counseling obviously works clearly in many cases. But for those cases when it might be beneficial to get both people in the room together, that's where I think this bill could really benefit and help homeowners in the state. The last thing I want to say is, it was talked about earlier about the second and third mortgage holders and getting them to the table. Well, what happens right now is if you are a homeowner and the first mortgage company wants to foreclose and they foreclose and you have a second mortgage, when that person comes to me and they say, well, what do I do, Mike? I said, well, has the foreclosure happened? Yeah, the sheriff's sale was 3 months ago. I explain to them, I say, you have one option and one option only, and that is to file bankruptcy. And they're going, well, why do I have to file bankruptcy? Well, because that debt on that second mortgage, you still owe it. That your obligation to repay that debt was not eliminated when your home was foreclosed. So I actually think having a mediation bill that actually encourages and requires the second and third mortgage holders to attend actually is beneficial, because I've had clients say, I don't want to file bankruptcy. I want to keep my home and I want to work through this. We could actually get all of the affected parties in a room together and actually negotiate, in those instances where it financially makes sense for everyone. And we might be able to avoid a foreclosure and actually have the second and third mortgage holders be active participants in resolving and working through that, rather than just kind of sitting back and waiting for the first to make its decision, foreclose, and then they're kind of left going, well, I guess now we need to sue the former homeowner and get a judgment against them. And then the former homeowner's going, Mike, why do I owe $52,000 on a loan that I thought was eliminated when my foreclosure happened? So I actually think it's beneficial for those seconds and thirds as well. So with that, I'll end my testimony. Thank you.
Mr. Davey, questions, comments from committee members? Okay, well, thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony. Representative Dean, you can wrap up, make some closing comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, testifiers, and thank you, members. I think we've had some compelling stories, and I thank you for the opportunity to move this forward. As I mentioned at the beginning, the bill still has some work to be done. We know that. There were some issues that were raised that have already been considered. It's never been our intent to have small banks who process less than 150 foreclosures to have to pay a fee. So just clarify, if that's what the bill does right now, that's not the intent of the bill, and we will try to rectify that. There was talk about what do homeowners have to do, how come they don't have to act in good faith? And to that I would just say, if a homeowner doesn't act in good faith, their home will be foreclosed upon. The bank will receive a good faith affidavit, and it will proceed as forward. So although there is some great concern about that, I think that the good faith that the homeowner would have to do would be to participate as best that they can. You know, we know that there is an issue around connecting with people that are having trouble. And we're trying to figure out a solution that begins to address that. So that will be something we'll work on over the next several weeks prior to session. I do want to take a moment and thank Prentice Cox from the University of Minnesota Law School, as well as a couple of students who we've been working with on this bill over the past several months to try to get something that covers what we want to have cover and also does what we wanted it to do. So I also want folks to think about this in a very different way. Many people see this as a remedy bill, and I don't think it's a remedy bill. If this bill would have been in place in 2006, we would not have had the crisis that we had. So although it's easy to think about a remedy to the current situation that some people still find themselves out, it will also give future protection for those individuals as they move forward and hit difficult times. So with that, I'm looking forward to the next few weeks and working on this bill and look forward to coming back to the committee. Thank you.
Thank you. Any comments or questions for the author? If not, thank you. Did a great job, brought a lot of people together, and I really appreciate it. Committee members, we're going to adjourn the meeting here. I just want to tell you that we probably won't be meeting until the first week of session, and I think it'll be Wednesday, the 26th. And at that time, we do have some bills on the agenda. If any of you have bills that you want me to put on the agenda, please let me know. We have some left over from last year and a few new ones. Yeah. Thank you very much, the committee. Oh, wait a minute. I want to thank our two volunteers who helped us today, Anne-Marie and Arlen, who volunteered with us. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much. Meeting is adjourned.